Hello, I'm Richard Deitch, and welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. Each week, we interview a member of the sports media on their process and how they do their job. This week, our guest is Elliot Friedman, one of the foremost NHL insiders in North America. You see him on Sportsnet in Canada as an insider and reporter for Hockey Night in Canada. In addition to that role, Elliot works for the NHL Network and regularly contributes to Sportsnet.ca, where he has his very popular and regular 30 Thoughts column. I asked Elliot Friedman about the impact of the great young players in the league, including Connor McDavid, Austin Matthews, and Jack Eichel.
Austin Matthews has a chance to be maybe Gary Bettman's greatest success story as commissioner in the National Hockey League. You know, here's a guy who basically admits that he's not playing hockey if it isn't for the Arizona Coyotes. Well, here's Gary Bettman and the Arizona Coyotes, who've been everybody's punching bag for almost a decade. He's been ripped mercilessly for all of his efforts to keep that team there. And by doing that, if this is what the result of it is, nobody can laugh at Arizona anymore.
We'll certainly get into many NHL questions, including the impact of these great young players. And we'll also get into Elliot's work at the Rio Olympics, where he was the subject of something he obviously did not want to be the subject of. In a major swimming race involving Michael Phelps and Ryan Lochte, Elliot made the wrong call of the finish. We're going to examine that. What happens when, in one of the biggest assignments of your life, it doesn't go the way you want? And I think you're really going to enjoy Elliot, who talked about this, I think, in almost emotional detail. That's all coming up on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. All right, hi, I'm Richard Deitch. Welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. My guest this week is Elliot Friedman, straight out of Toronto or somewhere up north. Elliot, how are you?
I am in Toronto, Richard. Good. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for taking the time to do this. When I put out on Twitter that you were going to be on the podcast, there were a ton of questions, which was great. We will save the listener questions to the end and start off with some process stuff, because you've had an interesting career and there are many interesting things you do. And what I want to start with is your 30 Thoughts column that you do for Sportsnet.ca is really filled with an immense amount of reporting. In the States, Peter King does sort of his own version of that on MMQB, where you really, if you're in the journalism field, you understand just how much reporting it takes to get one of those columns done. So as detailed as you can, how does that column come together each week? Because if I sort of just look at it, Elliot, it feels like that's a 50 to sometimes 100 call column to put that all together. So I'm interested in your process. Please go as long as you want on that.
Sure, Richard. I mean, the way it works, well, first I'll tell you where the genesis of it came. You know, a few years ago, we had a producer here named Doug Walton, who now he was at the Hockey Night in Canada when it was at CBC, and he now produces Blue Jays games for Rogers, the company I work for. And I was a sideline reporter oftentimes in NHL games that he would work. And I felt my job as a sideline reporter was to come to each game with about five or six independent ideas, and I would pitch them to Doug, and I'd try to get them on air. And one week, Doug said to me, and he says, the biggest shame is that a lot of weeks, and there's no way a sideline reporter is going to get on five or six times, so some of this stuff really goes to waste. You should do a column on how to do it, on all this stuff that you come up with. And I was like, you know, that's actually a pretty good idea. And I thought of, you know, I mean, obviously all of us grew up reading Peter Gammons, who I guess was kind of the originator of the notes column, right? And also was one time when I was a teenager and subscribed to Sports Illustrated, he was an SI staffer. So I thought about something like that, but I wanted to make it a little bit different. So I'm a big fan of alliteration, and there were 30 teams in the NHL, so I came up with 30 thoughts. Now, I will tell you, Richard, there are some weeks I really kick myself for coming up with the number 30. Like, I'm sitting there at 21, and I'm thinking, why on earth did I come up with 30? Why didn't I come up with 20 or something like that? And one of the questions I get is, now that Las Vegas is coming in next year, you're going to 31. And I'm like, oh, no, I don't know if I can do that. But so that's what the genesis of it was. And, you know, it was something that I liked the challenge of doing it. Like I said, there were weeks where I was way over 30, and I said, you know what, I'm gonna combine stuff or I'll save it till next week. And there's other weeks where I'm sitting there at 21 or 22, and I'm sitting there thinking, oh, how am I going to fix this? How am I going to finish it? But I like the challenge of it. I really enjoy the idea of trying to come up with all this stuff. And the other thing, too, is that one thing I've discovered is that people read it. And if it was something that nobody read, I might have packed it in a while ago, but I didn't need to do that because people seem to like it. So I think what's happened is, for example, the bigger challenge this year is that I'm not going on the road very much. It used to be I would work a lot of Wednesday games on the road as a sideline reporter. So I'd get out, I'd see the two teams, I'd get a few extra notes of guys I hadn't seen before. When a team comes through Toronto, I'll go to a practice or I'll go to the morning skate or the game and I'll get information. And then on Saturday, where I do a lot of my news gathering for the big show on hockey night, I'll use some of that stuff too. I won't be traveling very much this year, which will make it more of a challenge. But basically, like every reporter you have about who covers a league, you probably have about 15 to 20 people who are your go-to guys. And I'm constantly sending notes to them until they're sick of me. You know, what's going on? And they'll say, check out this or check out that. And, you know, it kind of goes from there. And between that and also talking to players, because you don't want it to only be rumors. You want it to be everything. You want it to be some fun stuff. You want it to be some good quotes. You want some technical stuff if you can get it, some storyline stuff. And I think between all of that is kind of how I get it done.
How long does it take to compile?
Well, my wife always says to me, why don't you start writing it earlier in the week? And that way you don't have to cram it all down in one night. And I've tried to do that, but I find whenever I do a thought earlier in the week, I'm always rewriting it at the end because I don't like it or I've learned more or whatever. And I think that is kind of the way I am. To actually write it, I'll start one night at like 6 or 7 o'clock. And it won't be unusual for me to be done not until 5 or 6 in the morning. It takes probably about 12 hours to really write. And then the next day is pretty much a write-off. But that's kind of the way it goes.
In terms of how you decide what to put in and what not to put in, often, Elliot, with these notes columns, and I'm sure Gammons, who you referred to, the famous Sunday notes column in the Boston Globe, I'm sure he had this issue as well. You know, there's going to be things that ultimately you know, but you don't put in that column. So how do you prioritize it? Are you always going, the most important news will always go in the column, or are you thinking thematically where maybe some hard news here, go to something funny here, go to a feature here? What's the thought process behind kind of the format of each individual week?
Well, number one is the most important news goes in. You know, the only reason I'll ever save something is because I'm not sure if it's 100% true or I kind of doubt the veracity of something. That's the only time that newsy stuff won't go in. I always try to get the news in. It's very rarely thematic, except, Richard, in the sense that, you know, at the end of the column, the last thing I do is I'll say, like, does this order make sense? Am I talking about the St. Louis Blues here in thought number 3? And then again, I'm talking about them in thought number 15 or 16. That doesn't make any sense. So I do try to tie things together that kind of work together. But other than that, it's the most important stuff goes in. And if stuff doesn't make it, then I'll hold it till next week or use it somewhere else. Sometimes when I'm a bit short, the guys joke with me, it's really 15 thoughts spread out over 30. Like, they kind of laugh about that. You know, Glenn Healy once said to me, and actually Glenn Healy and PJ Stock were two guys who said to me that sometimes the blog can be too much. Like, I use a lot more of smaller paragraphs now, like maybe one sentence paragraphs, a quote of the week or something like that, because they felt that sometimes when I was really detailed, it was too much to take in. So I do try to have less, like if I have a really big thought, I try to follow up with a small one, or if I have two or three in a row, I have a small one. And they both found, I think that's very fair. I think like a lot of listeners or readers are like that. You can't cram too much in on them. even more than I'm already trying to. So you have to break it up a little letter, a little better between large paragraphs and smaller, and hard newsy stuff and featurey or fun stuff. I always try to get a couple of really short ones in there.
One more on this, Elliot, and that is when it comes to your sources, you're not going to name who they are, but I would be interested in terms of who do you find to be the best sources when it comes to providing information between players, coaches, front office staffers, scouts, or someone maybe outside the normal framework of who we think of in the game?
I think, Richard, number one, I think it's, and I've been talking about this with some of the other guys, like McKenzie and LeBron and Nick Kiprios and Dreger, it's harder now. Teams are more secretive than ever, I think. You know, I had an interesting conversation with a friend of mine, with a guy I get along with really well, who was general manager at one point a couple of years ago. And we were very friendly, have a great relationship, but he said to me that you guys do not realize the effect you guys have on a dressing room. It all started out in a conversation that we had over something I knew that was going on with his team, and he had a long sigh, and he finally admitted it, and he just said, and that's what he told me. He says, you do not realize the impact that these things have. And that's a conversation that has always stuck with me, because at the end of the day, you know, we're all just trying to make a living, and we're all just trying to enjoy life, and, you know, you want to be as fair as you possibly can, and I try not, and I know I try not to really, like, affect people's lives, but we do. And I think we're sensitive to that, and I think teams have become even more sensitive to that because there's so much on the line. First of all, it's so hard to make the playoffs in the NHL. 16 teams make it, 14 teams don't. Next year, 15 teams won't. And the margin is razor thin. And there's so much on the line in terms of money, revenue, jobs, both on as players and front office people, that they are more guarded than ever, and I find that they push back more than ever. I think in the last 2 years, I've gotten into more disputes with people than I have in the previous 20 years of my career.
Wow, that's really
and
interesting.
And I think that, so I think it's tighter now. I think generally, first of all, Richard, I've always been surprised at how many people you can find a story from. Like, my mantra is, don't discount anybody. Just because maybe they don't have the fanciest title or the biggest job, you know, you never know where this person could know their information from. Test everything is my rule. And the other thing, too, is I just find that working for Hockey Night in Canada, people have more of a willingness to talk to you. It's the big show. I noticed at the moment I joined it in 2003, everybody viewed me differently because I worked for Hockey Night in Canada. And it's a positive because people like the show. They grew up with the show. They watch it. I mean, even though we had a bit of a rough year last year, people still identify me with that show. And I think the name power of that show helps me in my reporting.
For sure. And that's interesting. And obviously, having talked to a lot of sports journalists in the States, they've always talked about how when they are on television, and particularly a television show that carries either some weight or is just seen by a lot of people, it inevitably helps them with players and coaches in terms of recognizability. Hockey Night in Canada obviously also has the stature as well. Elliot, I had a I did a roundtable last week.
I saw it. It was very good.
Yeah, and some of your colleagues were part of that, including David Amber, John Shannon. But there were hockey voices all around the country, from Mike Harrington in Buffalo to whatever. You can sort of check. I'm not going to sort of prop up the piece here. You can check out the piece on SI.com. It really came out well because the reporters and voices really took it seriously and provided some interesting information. I wanted to ask you a couple questions from that roundtable, particularly the first one I asked them, and that was about what the most interesting story in the league will be this year. And it seemed almost universal that there's a belief, and I think a correct one, that the NHL is about to enter perhaps a real magical era with Austin Matthews, Connor McDavid, and Jack Eichel, and these truly transcendent young guys. Where I don't want to make it seem like we're entering the Gretzky-Lemieux era, but it seems like there's something that we're on the cusp of the NHL maybe crossing over with more fans, especially in stateside, than we've seen before. Do you believe that's right now the biggest story in the league, the sort of emergence of this perhaps golden generation?
Absolutely. And I do think that. And where I think it started was at the World Cup of Hockey with the under-24 team. When people saw how that team played, they were enthralled. They were the darlings and the stars of that tournament. There were people going into that tournament saying that team wouldn't win a game. And they beat Sweden, they beat Finland, they barely lost to Russia. On a Saturday night in the semifinals in Canada, we had Canada versus Russia in the one game, and it did a great number. Our guys were very excited. But there was almost a disappointment, because if the team had advanced, that under-23 team or under-24 team, they would have played Canada. And every one of us wanted to see that. Like, Russia was playing Finland in their last game of the round robin. And I never cheer. I was on the air basically cheering for Finland. Because no offense to the Russians, I just wanted that game. Canada versus the under-24 team, North America. And it was funny, Matt Duchene came on during that game. He was out at an event and he agreed to come on between periods. Or I think it was actually the later game that night. And he said, and I asked him, are you guys disappointed that you didn't get a chance to play North America? And he laughed and he says, no, but I know you guys were disappointed. So, like, and I think, and who played on that team? Auston Matthews played on that team. Connor McDavid played on that team. Johnny Gaudreau played on that team. Jack Eichel played on that team. And they were phenomenal to watch. And, you know, you look at the start of the season, our first night was Ottawa. And what happened? We got a 4-goal game. And then Toronto versus Winnipeg. And what did we get? We got a Patrick Laine hat trick with the game winner coming right after we had a situation where Auston Matthews was stopped on a breakaway in overtime. Like, I mean, that is magic. It is magic. And the people here were going bananas in Canada watching those games. And I think it's just a situation, Richard, where last year was such a rough year for hockey in Canada especially, that the Canadian fans can't get enough of this. And the other thing, too, is Matthews. And I've kind of talked about this with some people. Auston Matthews has a chance to be maybe Gary Bettman's greatest success story as commissioner in the National Hockey League. You know, here's a guy who basically admits that he's not playing hockey if it isn't for the Arizona Coyotes. Well, here's Gary Bettman and the Arizona Coyotes, who've been everybody's punching bag for almost a decade. He's been ripped mercilessly for all of his efforts to keep that team there. And by doing that, if this is what the result of it is, nobody can laugh at Arizona anymore. And I look at Matthews and his ability, the fact he's American, the fact that the NHL fought to keep that team there against A, overwhelming odds, and B, a lot of mocking, you know, I think it's a pretty special story.
Elliot, this sort of parallels into what you just talked about in terms of, I mean, that's a pretty interesting thought by you in terms of Auston Matthews being, you know, perhaps sort of the savior for Gary Bettman, particularly if he's a star in Toronto. But one of the things that the NHL has really suffered, particularly last year, maybe even the last couple of years, was really having a major presence in the States. Now, NBC's ratings at times have gone up, but it seems so predicated on if you can get Chicago in the final, or if you can get Philadelphia in the final. If you end up with like Tampa Bay, San Jose in the final, you're cooked. It's over for the American audience. How do you, as someone based in Toronto, how do you view the NHL's presence outside of Canada?
I give the worst answer to these questions, Richard, because I'm not a please like my sport guy. You know, I'm a big believer in, I love hockey, and if you don't like it, that's your problem. Now, that's why I could never be a commissioner of a league, because I tend to think like that. But, you know, I mean, I understand it. It's hockey is still very regional. You know, there's a reason the Chicago Blackhawks end up in a lot of these outdoor games. Like a lot of sports now, I think it's if your team is in, you're watching. If your team is out, you know, you're not watching. And the NHL probably takes as big a hit on that as anyone. You know, Matthews has a chance to be potentially a transcendent player, and I think that's a great thing. But, you know, I think the bigger question right now, Richard, is, you know, I've been reading all your stories and everybody else's stories on the NFL. We always thought that was the ratings-proof league, right?
Right.
And we're going through an era now where, you know, the TV companies don't know yet how to handle it. to me, there's not much you can really do about that. Like, if Tampa Bay and San Jose meet in the final, it would be a hell of a final, a fantastic final. And if people aren't watching, my response would be, you know, you're really missing something. I don't worry about that kind of stuff. But I just think at the end of the day, to me, and this was also touched on by the people in your piece this week, the hockey panel, at some point in time, the sport is going to have to do a better job of embracing personalities.
Right.
And I think that day is starting to come. The new generation of young people, they're out there. They don't believe in privacy. Very few of them. They're out there on social media. They're branding themselves very quickly. And I do think that hockey is at the tip of the iceberg and learning how are we going to deal with this.
One of the interesting things from that panel, speaking of sort of branding and marketing personalities, one of the interesting answers in that panel was when I asked them which current players they thought could make a very successful transition to television or radio after their career ended and why. And the unanimous pick, essentially mentioned, I think, by almost every panelist, yep, was P.K. Subban, yep, now obviously with the Predators, an incredibly charismatic guy. And you, as well as particularly honest and obviously a great player, you have worked with PK. Am I correct about this?
Yes.
Okay, so you are a perfect guy to ask. One, I'd be curious to get your answer to that question on other current players who you think could morph into broadcasting. And then secondly, why were these hockey minds saying that they thought PK is a can't-miss broadcaster if this is where he wants to go?
Well, the second part of your question, I think, is pretty obvious because he's honest. He's not going to allow himself to be shackled by anybody. Only once have I really heard PK duck a question. I can't remember what it was exactly, but I did the interview. It was on radio during the NHL lockout. I asked him something about one of the recent proposals or something that had come out, and he refused to answer it. And I remember saying, this is notable because I've never heard you refuse to answer a question anymore. And he kind of laughed. And I think in hockey, I'll tell you this, I think there's more guys than we realize. One of the biggest problems I think we have in hockey is that these guys have better personalities than they're willing to show. And part of that is because the sport really is it's team, it's not individual. And you know, that's one of the reasons obviously that the Montreal Canadiens feel that PK Subban's not a member of their organization anymore. And so I think that when I say that the sport's coming to a crossroads, what I do mean is that there's a time that these teams are going to have to realize they're going to have to accept a bit more individuality, not at the expense of the team, but the understanding that this is where we're going. You know, I watch Inside the NBA because I think it's the best studio show of all time. And one of the biggest differences we have in the NBA and the NHL is, number one, those players, they're honest. They're going to say whatever they want to say, and there's nothing you can do about it. Whenever we have guys come on the air to do hockey broadcast post-career, there's a real feeling of, you know, I don't want to criticize anybody I know, and I really don't like to criticize the game. I don't know if it's because they still want to work in the game or they're just, it's the way they're brought up through the sport. It's very different in the mentality. The NHL players are not like the NBA players in the willingness to come out and say what's on their mind. The second thing is, I think the money is so much better for broadcasting football and basketball,
right,
that it's more worth their while. There's guys in hockey who make a lot of money. We don't pay them enough to come out to do that. And I don't know if that's ever going to change. But I look at the NBA guys, and I have an idea of what they make, and some of the NFL guys and what they make. And I just think that, and I know because I was pursued once to work in the States, I was told, you know, this isn't the NFL. We don't pay the same. So I think the willingness to pay that kind of top dollar, Richard, makes a big difference too.
Elliot, you can be in an interesting position because you work for Rogers. You work, yep, on a very high-profile property, Hockey Night in Canada. Yet, as an insider, there will be times where you come across information that does not make the NHL look good. Yet, your mm-hmm. company has a massive financial interest in hockey and hockey doing well. How do you individually negotiate and manage when There are stories to be done that will not put the NHL in a good light, understanding that ultimately your biggest employer is a rights holder and partner with the league.
Well, we went through a lot of this when we were at the CBC. There were times when, and for those of you who are listening to this, we're not exactly familiar until the beginning of the 2013-14 season, Hockey Night in Canada was on CBC. And after that year, Rogers bought the rights and Sportsnet now controls the NHL. And so our previous incarnation with CBC, there were times we really had a contentious relationship with the NHL. Obviously, if you're familiar with hockey, you know Ron McLean's story, that after the CBC lost the rights, he lost the job for 2 years. And Ron had a very contentious relationship with the commissioner to the point where the commissioner refused to appear on our air for a while. And my situation with the league wasn't as upfront, but there were people in the league who told me during lockouts they felt I was way too pro player, and they had some problems with it. They would tell me privately. And, you know, they were professional about it. We disagreed. I know there were times I lost stories because of it. And I do think that while at the end of the day, the reason CBC lost the rights was money, not that first and foremost and nothing else. I know the relationship was difficult at times, that, you know, there were times at CBC they were concerned about some of the things that I was working on. And you have to ask Ron about what specifically happened with him.
Right.
You know, I would just say this, Richard. You know, there's been very few occasions like where Rogers has come to me and said, don't do this or don't do that. I'll tell you one story. When I was hired, as I was going through the interview process, we used to talk a lot about escrow, the money that got held from the players and how angry they were about it. One of my new bosses said to me, I hope I never hear the word escrow on the air. So, and he kind of laughed about it, but he was half joking. I think what that says is they want the focus to be on the game and the players. They don't want the focus to be on some of the other stuff. Now, I've never been told not to report on anything. It's never happened. But I think we all recognize that there is a line we walk. I think it's a bit more free on radio. On radio, I've been critical of Rogers at times for their way they run the Blue Jays. I've talked about some things that I'm sure doesn't make the NHL happy. I just know on TV, they prefer it to be about the games and the stars.
That's interesting. So in a way, that's sort of messaging you without saying the explicit message. Do you think it has made you pull any punches just on a human nature level?
No, I don't think it has. What I think it does is, I have a belief that I have. It's called save your bullets. I follow you on Twitter. I know a lot of your stuff. And one of the things sometimes I agree with you about is the shows that are all about yelling,
right?
First Take. And the one thing I believe is if you're like that all the time, it loses its ability to appeal to people. People get fed up with that. They can't watch a person who's like that all the time. So I'm a big believer in you save your bullets. So if you're going to be critical of something or you're going to mention something, it carries weight. So what I told my boss about that was, I won't go crazy on escrow, but when it comes to air, it's going to matter. And that's kind of the way I look at it, that I will save my bullets so that when I fire them, nobody's going to complain about it too much, and it will carry weight. That's the way I believe you do it.
One more Hockey Night in Canada question for me, and then I'm going to go to a lot of listener questions. Did the Ron McLean situation, and for the listeners who don't know, he came in this year replacing the Hockey Night in Canada host last year, and I'm going to mispronounce his name, George Strombopoulos,
George Strombopoulos.
Okay, pretty close. Okay. So
that's
obviously that
one.
Right.
Tongue twister.
Yeah. So that in Canada, that was a major media story.
Yes.
If I was working in Canada on the beat I have at Sports Illustrated, it would have been something I would have written about multiple times. And, you know, the Hockey Night in Canada host is a significant, major position in Canada. You are in the middle of this, Elliot. You don't make the hiring decisions, but you ultimately, you're part of the chemistry that has to exist on this show. Mm-hmm. One, was working under that framework last year difficult at all? And two, how has the transition impacted you?
I don't think the transition's impacted me a lot. I mean, at the end of the day, it's sort of like if a coach gets fired and a player loved that coach, you still have to show up and play for the next coach, right? So I don't look at it as it impacted me a great deal. You still have to do your job, and you still have to, and it's like Bill Belichick, do your job well.
Right.
So I don't think it impacted me a lot personally. I've worked with Ron. I've worked with George. I know what they're both like. I didn't see it as being a huge adjustment for myself. And at the end of the day, you only want the viewers to be happy with your show. What it was like to work in that, I mean, we all kind of had a sense it was coming. You know, last year was such a difficult year. You know, the Canadian teams weren't doing well. And to me, at the end of the day, that's the biggest thing. You know, our ratings are going to be better this year, Richard, as long as everybody stays healthy. Because look at what these guys have done 2 weeks into the season. And that, at the end of the day, the product sells. You know, I think we, as a show, we can make the show better or we can make the show worse by the job we do on the air every week. But we are the secondary product. The primary product is the game. And this year, if this continues like this, the ratings will be better because the game is better. You know, it wasn't easy. You know, I think I've always been sensitive to reporting things that affect people's livelihoods. And if we ever needed any reminder of that, it was last year. We knew there were going to be changes, and we went through the playoffs just waiting for them to happen. And it's not easy for anybody. It was very difficult on certain people. But at the end of the day, Richard, you have to be professional. You have to do your job. And we just sat there and we did it to the best of our abilities until we knew what was going on.
All right, let's get to some listener questions. This was an interesting one because this question could be asked in any major market in the States as well as a lot of college markets. And that is the sort of the overthought speculation in the Canadian sports media, that's obviously this listener's perception,
yeah,
towards Canadian sports teams. How much influence does it have on a fan base's optimism or negativity? And I imagine a lot of this question may be geared towards Toronto and maybe the Maple Leafs, where it seems that historically, obviously the team hasn't performed well, but there's a lot of negativity around that team and so much sort of coverage and pressure when it comes to those players. Maybe that's the same in Montreal too, which is a very rabid hockey market.
You know, I think at times it has exerted huge influence. And where I think it exerts the biggest is at the ownership level. Because these men and women who are connected to teams, they get hammered by their friends. How come your team sucks? Why did you do this? And I tell you, this happens more than I realize. And like I'll tell you, last year I said something on the air, and the next morning, and it was early, I got a call from the team saying, "You got to apologize to our owner for what you said." I said, "I'm not doing that. I didn't say anything bad." And I knew it was going to be a problem because the moment I said it, the market ran wild with it. I said, "I'm not apologizing to him. I didn't say anything bad." And it was funny because that night was the NBA All-Star game. It was in Toronto. And I had tickets to the game that night. So, you know, the owner texted me later in the day. He says, "I want to talk to you." I said, "Look, I'm at the All-Star game. Can we talk later?" And he said, "Sure." And right when the Del Curry hit like a half-court shot right before the final buzzer, Stephen Curry, not Del Curry. But the moment it went in and the buzzer went, I'd barely gotten out of my seat on the concourse when my phone rang. And, you know, I just said to him, I said, "Did you see it?" And he goes, "No, I haven't seen it." And he goes, "But all my friends are calling me and saying, Elliot just killed you on the air." And I'm like, okay, I had made sure from our guys at work, who are great, our guys on the desk and who run highlights, they're awesome. They're so fast and they're on the ball. And Sunday's their day off. And I reached out to one of them and I said, "I need this." And so they got it to me and I texted it to him. And 20 minutes later, he texts me, he says, "This is nowhere near that bad." But it was instructive to me about what it's like for these people. They're very sensitive. And you need in Canada, you to be a successful general manager in Canada or a coach or an owner or anything, you need to have balls of steel. And I did an event with the commissioner a couple of weeks ago during the World Cup where we were talking to Maple Leaf Sports and Entertainment. There were a lot of young people in the crowd. And I asked him, I said, there's a lot of young people in this crowd today, and they want to be a big-time executive like you are. What's the best advice you could give them? And he gave what I thought was a great answer. And that was that when you make a decision, you have to stick with that decision. There are always going to be people who are telling you you're wrong. There's always going to be people that criticize you. But if you believe you're right and you've done your research and the evidence indicates you're right, you have to believe you're right and you have to go through with it. And I believe that is so true. I think in Canada, the media can make a difference. And one of the reasons I think that Lou Lamoriello and Mike Babcock will be successful in Toronto is because these guys make it very clear they will answer all of our questions, but they legitimately do not care what we think in terms of making those decisions for them. And I think you have to be that kind of guy or you will not be successful.
Were there University of Western Ontario students in that audience? Ellie?
Probably. I'm assuming there were some.
Your alma mater.
I do always say this. I've never graduated. I'm a right. credit and a half shy.
I read that. I guess one of my questions for you was going to be, why not just, can't you go online and just take that class and get the degree?
I'm going to do it. Like, for years, I didn't want to do it. I'll tell you why. Number one is, I do think sometimes people get caught in the idea that they have to go to university. And I wanted to tell people that just because you don't have a university degree doesn't mean you're not going to be successful.
Right, totally true.
That was one. And the other one, I will admit, you know what I have to take? I have to take an algebra and a Shakespearean English.
Oof.
I have no desire to take those. None. So I'm mustering it up, and I've started to look into it, and I think in the next couple of years I will finish it.
The English one, I think you could pull off. The algebra one, that's not going to be easy.
You know what I'll tell you? The algebra one's only half a year. The English one is a full year course, which I think, last time I checked, they told me it was 4 essays and 2 exams. I just don't have time for that.
And that's a lot, I will say that.
I'd hire someone to write it for me, but I'm worried they'd catch me.
Yeah, I feel like that might be illegal, even in Canada. Is there a disconnect between the Canadian hockey media and Canadian hockey fans when it comes to Russian, European players, Alex Ovechkin, et cetera?
Yes and no. I don't know. I'll tell you this. I think people are more accepting of Russian players than they ever were. I mean, the world is a different place now. I think that, you know, where it really comes out is, I think people love Alexander Ovechkin 95% of the time. The 5% are when his team loses in the playoffs or if Russia loses in a big game, particularly against Canada.
Right.
Then he takes all the heat. Like, for example, he got blamed again this year at the World Cup, and I thought he played hard, and I thought Malkin was some of the worst I've ever seen him play. But I think that comes with it, Richard. You're the highest paid guy. You're the most visible guy. You get the credit. You take the heat. But unless like Canada and Russia are playing in a big game, I never hear that stuff anymore. I think people understand that if you didn't have the European and Russian players and you got 31 teams, the league would be awful.
Another question here, Elliot. You appear often on Sportsnet 590. That's also
yep.
a station I appear on often as well. How interested are you in terms of hosting radio long term? Would that be something that would be of interest to you to get your own show there and to do that in addition to your other jobs?
I don't think I could do it in addition. I think it would have to be one or the other. And the reason I will say that is because I don't think I could do the job I do now and a radio show 5 days a week and be good at both.
Hmm.
If you're really committed to your craft, you can't. You know, everybody thinks that Bob McCowan shows up those 15 hours a week and doesn't do any research. And I know Bob likes to perpetuate that stereotype.
Right.
I think that's all bullshit, Richard. I really do. I think Bob does do a lot of work at it. I don't think you can do that show without working at it, crafting your thoughts, having an idea on what you want to do. And you know Bob, he's a master orator and wordsmith.
Right.
I don't think you can do that show off the cuff. I would like to do radio at some day, but it's probably going to be when my TV career is done, or unless Rogers decides my TV career is done, I have to go into it.
Right.
So I would, but I don't think you can do both.
Well, yeah, Bob McCowan, I totally agree with you. I think he loves to perpetuate that. I think he watches more than he lets on.
Yeah.
And, you know, obviously I'm incredibly fond of him. He's been certainly great to me. There are very few sports broadcasters I've ever come across who ask as smart and direct questions as Bob, but makes it, and this is the key, Ellie, I think you'd agree, but does it in a conversational tone where the subject does not feel they're either being berated or interrogated, and it turns into a conversation rather than an interrogation. And I think that's Bob's genius. He makes his interviews feel like a conversation, which does not, by the way, happen very often in the States. Much of sports radio in the States is this guy sucks, or I'm bringing this guy on to attack him because it's going to be great antagonistic radio. As you know, Elliot, having hosted PTS, very different on PTS. PTS is really about a conversation, even if you have somebody on you disagree with.
Yes, that's true. Bob used to have some big ones. You should ask him about the mayor of Hamilton sometime.
Okay.
But he doesn't do it anymore. He used to go out of his way to do it occasionally, but that is
changed. So you're saying I caught him in his his golden years.
In his mellow older years.
Nice. All right. So there you go.
But I will say this. I don't know what it is, Richard, but I think when you cross the border between our two countries, there are very different standards of what's acceptable.
Right.
I listen to a lot of sports radio in the States, particularly when I do travel, and I hear a lot of things that wouldn't work in Canada. And I hear a lot of things in Canada where we're a bit more genteel. But although we have our moments, we are a bit more genteel that I don't think would fly in the States.
Right. Well, we won't get into a political discussion, Elliot, but it all morphs that way. I think at one point, you mentioned this on this podcast too, but you were contemplating moving to the States, or at least considering jobs in the States. Has that moment passed at this point, given you have an exceptional job in Canada, or would you still consider moving to the States if somebody overwhelmed you with an offer?
I think it's unlikely. I want to be here. My family and I, we like it here. There was something I pursued not too long ago, and I was kind of told that ship had sailed. And I understood that because it was a job I turned down at one particular point. So I don't know where it would be now. To be honest, and I'm opening up a bit of a can of worms here, I think what happened to me at the Olympics probably ruined my final chance. And I'm okay with that. I think when you're younger, you have an understanding that you think that, well, I have to go to the United States to really prove myself. I don't believe that anymore. I think I've cut out a pretty decent career. If the right opportunity came up, I think I would, maybe I'd consider it. But the fact is, I want to be here. You know, we like it here. My family's happy here. And the other thing, too, you know what the best advice that Bob ever told me was? And this is probably the best advice I ever received when I was younger in my career. As he told, the best advice he ever gave me was don't f*** with happy. You know, right now I'm happy. He talked to me about, you meet a lot of people who leave a job for $5,000 or $10,000 more, and you regret it. And I'm a big believer in that. I very rarely moved in my career. It doesn't take a lot to make me happy. A good working environment, great people to be around. We have that. I think probably, Richard, that's done. And that's fine. I'm good with that.
Let's get into that, because you said something that I thought was really interesting here. And obviously, I wanted to talk about the Olympics.
Yep.
I'm not saying this to kiss your ass. I don't buy into that thesis at all, that would absolutely...
I've been told that.
Well, that's interesting.
Yes.
Once again, proving that there are a lot of sports executives who are idiots. But whatever. Uh-huh. We'll sort of move on from that. I still am not sure I buy that. But let's talk about this. At the Rio Olympics, you pretty much lived every announcer's nightmare. You mixed up Michael Phelps and Ryan Lochte while calling the 200-meter IM final. You, I think, handled that perfectly. You admitted it right away. You let people know that you know you made a mistake and that you felt awful about it, and what's done was done. So that's sort of the context or the background of this. But when you realized, Elliot, that you made a mistake, which you did in real time and on the air in front of millions of people, you must have felt, I imagine, sick to your stomach.
Yeah, that was pretty brutal. There's no other way to say it. It sucked. It was 48 really brutal hours, Richard. I guess that's the best way I'd put it.
After that, Elliot, did you hang out with people from your network? Did you want to be alone? What were the immediate hours after?
I was alone.
Okay, and why did you choose that?
I didn't want to be with anybody. I was embarrassed. I felt I'd let my network down. I felt I let myself down. I felt I let my family down. I was really disappointed in myself for doing it. I wasn't mad at anybody else. I've had people ask me about certain things that happened, and I don't blame anybody else. I blame myself, and that's it. People have told me, I'm over it in the sense that I don't think about it anymore, but it is, like, the scars do run deep whenever I do talk about it. And, I saw in my Twitter feed after you tweeted out about the podcast last night that someone asked to ask about this, and I was like, okay, I'm not going to run away from it. I don't like to talk about it. I generally, when people ask me about it, I try to turn the conversation, but I realize for this audience, I don't think that's possible. I don't think I'll ever laugh about it. I think the most interesting thing, Richard, you asked me earlier about covering the NHL. There are certain people I will never be able to criticize again. I think the only thing that, and I admit that, I'm compromised as a reporter that way, because the only thing that was good about it was the surprising people who reached out. And I won't say who they were, but I was blown away by some of the people that reached out, including some people in the American broadcast industry who I don't really know, who somehow tracked me down.
Hmm.
And that was the only good thing about it. But the only person I talked to was my wife and my boss. I talked to my wife and my boss, and that was it. And I didn't talk to anybody else. And I remember the next day, that night, actually, after it was over, I sat in the swimming pool. I was the last guy to leave. I didn't want to go anywhere. And there was a guy, the way we were set up was our seat next to us on our left was the Israeli broadcasting team. And I'd met them, and one of the Israeli guys just wanted to talk to me, and I just said, please leave me alone. Like, I blew him off. I think he was actually kind of offended, but I didn't want to talk to anybody. And, the next day, you show up in the morning for the heats, and I will admit the next day was the most scared I've ever been to go on air. I was terrified. And but I just stayed by myself all day. The broadcast team came over to do the race with me. They said, why don't you come back and go for lunch with us? And I was like, no. And, I just didn't want to be with anybody. Now, I should say a couple other things. First of all, aside from letting down the entire network, I think the reason I was most disappointed was that, I don't know if people are familiar with the story, but we have a pretty legendary swimming broadcaster here in Canada, a guy by the name of Steve Armitage. He was supposed to call the swimming, and 2 weeks before the Olympics, we found out he had a heart problem and he couldn't go.
Mm.
So they put me in that seat 2 weeks beforehand, and I think it would have been an easy excuse to use, but I really believe, Richard, I could do the job, and I was very disappointed in myself for not doing the job.
Elliot,
that one really hurt, because I felt I was doing a really good job up until that point, and I was disappointed that I'd failed. And the other thing, too, I would like to say is there was a guy who was my boss there at the games, and he actually drove from the command center that night to the swimming pool to try and snap me out of it. So, I mean, I really do appreciate that. I think the other thing, too, is, and the American and international viewers don't know this, this is the final story I'm going to tell about this, is that I almost blew the next race, too. And that was the one where Penny Oleksiak won the gold medal for Canada. And see, here's what happened. This is, and I realize this is a really long answer, and
no,
I'm rambling,
okay.
But
no,
what the hell. This is what happened in that race with Phelps. We had a great seat, Canada did, the broadcasting CBC. We were right at the finish line. But what it meant was we couldn't see the other side of the pool as clearly. There was a video board over top of the pool, okay, that faced the media. And it was simply, it wasn't I shouldn't say a video board, it was more like a screen. And what it showed was who was in what lane and what place they touched each wall. So you know when a person touched the wall, where they stood from first to eighth. And I checked that wall every time. Every race, every time someone touched that wall, except once. And that one time was the Phelps Lochte. So I would tell everybody out there that if you have a routine, don't ever vary from it. Because I varied from my routine once, and if it works for you, keep to it. I varied from mine once, and look what happened. So the next race is Alexiak, and she's having an unbelievable week. And I really thought I'd pulled myself together. And she goes out. It's the 100-meter freestyle. She goes out at 50. She's seventh. And I said, and one guy told me later, I almost turned off the TV before you said this. Alexiak's in seventh, but don't forget, in the heats in the morning, her back 50 closing was the fastest of anyone in the field. And that's what happened. She caught them. But between the time and those 50 and 100, twice I referred to Alexiak as Emily Overholt, who was another Canadian swimmer. Now, I didn't even realize I'd done it until the end. But what happened was, at the end, there was a tie between Alexiak and the American, Simone Manuel.
Right.
And the reason I knew that Alexiak had won was that I looked up at that video board, and there was a one next to her name. So I knew she'd touch first. And our commentator was a bit confused because he thought that Manuel won, but I'd called it. And 2 days later, when I was still down, I was sitting by myself at the pool, and I believe the broadcaster was from Australia, but I'm not sure. I think it was an Australian. He came up to my seat, and I was just there by myself, and he said, "Are you Elliot Friedman from Canada?" And this was after the Michael Rosenberg article had come out. And I said, "Yes, that's me." And you don't understand, like, I'd done Dutch TV. I was world famous for being a complete moron. And he said, "I want to show you something." And he plopped something into his iPad, and he said, "You know, this is the finish of the 100 meters the other night. I understand that you called it correctly that Alexiak won." I said, "Yes, that's probably the only good thing I've done this week." And he showed me, because I never looked at the screen on our desks, and I guess that's the same that you have on TV, and the lanes come up at the end as who's won. And I guess Manuel's name came up first. It said Manuel won, and the second one that came up was Alexiak with an OR. And he pointed out to me that because of that, he says, "You called Alexiak, right?" And I said, "Yes, it said she won the gold." He said to me, "You're the only guy in this building who got that call right."
Wow.
He said that I asked everybody else I know, and we all called Manuel as the winner because her name came up first. And he said, in the United States, that's fine because that's all they care about. But in your country, you would have been wrong if you did what everybody else did. But because you looked at that screen, you were right, and you called it in real time. And that was actually what started to pull me out of the funk, was that, you know, I realized I hadn't been an abject failure, just a partial one.
Well, first of all, I appreciate you talking about this. I know that it's not easy. There is something I want to ask you, though, and I remember thinking this after I heard the call. And obviously, I read Michael Rosenberg is my colleague. He wrote, I thought, a really terrific piece about what you were going through. Announcers have fuck-ups. I realize it's not going to make you feel better, but this is the reality of the profession. I understand the magnitude of the Olympics, but things happen. I wonder if part of the reason why this really impacted you, particularly later in the next day, was because it's 2016 now, and an announcer's call on a network in Canada can go global, where in 1985 it would not. Was the power of the web something that sort of freaked you out, that you just thought your name was going to be in every site in the world that does, like, broadcaster gaffes or something?
No, that did not affect me in the least bit.
Okay.
I deal with social media all the time. I know what happens. We see it. I wasn't worried about that. You know, hours later, I checked my phone and somebody had texted me and said, "Stay off the internet." So I did realize that. And it was probably about 4 or 5 hours later, because I didn't sleep that night, that I really realized that it was going viral. And I decided I was going to stay off Twitter anyway. In those moments, I think it's just best to take a time out. I was just crushed because I knew I blew it. And I'll tell you this. The reaction, people say that Twitter's like a cesspool. You know what? Those people were great.
Yeah.
There were some people that were jerks, but the percentage was really low. I was really pleasantly surprised when I checked the next day. I mean, now it's funny because Twitter has all their porn bots, so they retweet all the negative ones in my timeline from that day.
Right.
And now that I do laugh at. But Twitter was really not a problem. The media people who know me, whether for hockey or somewhere else, they were fine. Like, it was kind of weird, the foreign countries, like when I saw what was getting done in like Germany or the UK or Australia or New Zealand, or, you know, and there were a couple of people who are in the business in North America who took big runs at me, and those I do remember. I'm not a total nice guy. I do remember that. But I, you know, generally, I think I probably got away much better than most people would have expected. I was just crushed because I did it. It wouldn't, even if nobody had heard it, Rich, I would have known, and that was enough.
The last one, and this again was a question from a listener, and I thought fair, and that was, Elliot, do you think working for a Canadian broadcasting company, your bosses handled this differently as opposed to if you worked for an American broadcasting company or a British broadcasting company? I wonder if there's something unique to working in Canada. Like you said before, generally speaking, I think more of a sort of a genteel broadcasting culture, smaller culture, so everybody knows everybody. Do you think it's a different situation working in Canada than if you did that for BBC or NBC?
I don't know enough about those places to know, Richard. I don't think I'm qualified to answer that question. You know, I think one of my bosses who wasn't at the Olympics, I thought said it great to me after when we talked about it. He said that, you have a lot of equity. Now you used most of it up and you're going to have to build it back, but you have a lot of equity. And I thought that was the best way to put it.
Yeah, that's well said.
You know, I had people who wrote to me and said, it's kind of weird, like the reaction. I had someone, I don't even know how they got my home address, but they wrote me a letter and they said they were a female viewer and they said, if you were a woman, you wouldn't have your job anymore. And it was an anonymous letter. Yeah. And, you know, I don't know. Maybe, maybe not. But I think at the end of the day, I think my boss was right. I had some equity and I burned it, but I had it. And, you know, the only other reason I would disagree is one of the people who reached out to me was an American. And he told me about a bad call he had that he thought it was going to destroy his career, and he got backed. So I like to think it's probably more of a case-by-case basis. Now, if I ever did something like that again, I don't think I would survive it, but I hope it doesn't happen.
The last one I wanted to get on, Elliot, and I appreciate the time you've given me today, was there was someone who reached out to you, I think via Facebook. It was a young hockey fan who really loved watching hockey, I think loved watching you, who passed away. And you were particularly touched by this fan and made them a video from the Hockey Night in Canada studios that they played at the memorial service for, I think it was it a 12-year-old boy?
I think he was, you know what, I should know this, but I want to say it was 14.
14.
But I could be wrong.
Right. Yeah. And people should sort of can Google this up, but like, I thought that was a pretty, just a really impressive thing that you did, and the family made it public and mentioned that this really meant something to them. So I realize it's not, you didn't do this for publicity's sake, but I wonder if you could just,
like it, the video got out.
Yeah, I wonder if you could just sort of explain how that came together and what compelled you to make the video for the family.
You know, I should say that, like, despite the fact the video got out and I wasn't happy about it, I don't have any ill will towards the family. They're going through enough. They don't need that. Basically what happened was, not long after got back, it was early in September, I got a tweet from someone, and I can't remember exactly how it went, but I think the boy's name was Daniel Pumphrey.
Right.
And his cousin tweeted at me and explained what happened, and, you know, I went and looked at the young man's Twitter page, and, you know, I was like struck dumb. I remember I was, you know, it was in the afternoon in Toronto here, and as, you know, fate would have it, we were about to go pick up my own son, who's 5 years old, from the daycare. And so my wife came downstairs, like, okay, are we going to go? And I was kind of just sitting there, like, struck dumb. And I explained to her what happened. It was, you know, you're going to pick your own son up from daycare, and you're thinking about this. basically, as I understand it, it was the first day of school in Alberta, the province where he lived, and he had an aneurysm and he died. There was nothing they could do. And, you know, I'm just imagining, you know, we have gone through not exactly the same situation. You know, my mother died when she was 35. You know, my grandparents, I was very close with my maternal grandparents. So I've seen how brutal it is to bury a child. And my grandfather, who was, well, actually both my grandparents were Holocaust survivors, but my grandfather had was previously married and had a two-year-old that died in the camps. So my grandfather did it twice. And I just, you know, from living it and talking about it with them, I know how brutal that is. So I can never compare. It's never been my own child, thank God, so I don't know exactly, but I have an idea. So, you know, I still have that tweet. Like, I think the last thing he tweeted was directly at me. He said, "Everybody makes mistakes," or something like that.
Right,
I still have it.
Right.
I have a picture of it on my phone, and I have it bookmarked on my laptop. But, you know, like, I think in that moment, you know, I don't think that, Richard, that broadcasters are any more special than anybody else just because we're on TV. But I think there are people out there, especially when you've been around for a while, and my career now is 23 years, you know, they see you as somebody who's in their house every week, and they can grow an attachment to you. And I just thought, you know, to take 5 minutes out and send a message was, you know, just if there was anything I could do to ease them a little bit, I thought it was my duty to do that. And that's what we did, and we sent it to them. And like I said, I wasn't really thrilled it got out because some of that stuff was very personal, but I'm not really too upset or angry about it because at the end of the day, if you help bring that family a little bit of peace, I mean, that's the most important thing.
Right, and I've just sort of called up Daniel Thomas Pumphrey from Stony Plain, Alberta.
That's him.
Right, passed away at the tender age of 14. He was a huge Oilers Eskimos fan, Jays and Raptors fan, and a very big sports fan. And as Elliot said, I think his last tweet was to Elliot after the Olympics to sort of say people make mistakes. So it seems like a pretty incredible kid. So,
and you know what, Richard, too, I should say is that the family didn't know we did that until, I guess what happened, the cousin explained it to me, was that the family told him what happened, and he said, oh, and he went and did it, and they didn't know until after he died.
Wow.
Because they checked his social media, and that was his last tweet.
Wow, wow. All right, well, I think we'll end it there in memory of that young man. Elliot Friedman is a Hockey Night in Canada insider. You can also obviously hear him on Sportsnet 590. His 30.
I should mention in the States now, I do the NHL Network twice a week. They'll be happy if I mention.
Does that. The NHL Network twice a week, has his 30 Thoughts column. And is a proud member of, as Bob McCowan likes to say, perhaps the greatest North American city, Toronto. It's right up there with New York. It's probably tied. All right, listen, Elliot, I really appreciate you doing this. You're someone, when I started this podcast, I wanted to have on. And so I really appreciate the conversation, and I'm sure our paths will come across again. But thank you very much for being on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
My pleasure, Richard, anytime.
All right, back in the studio for a quick wrap-up with Lou Pellegrino. Lou, you're a big hockey fan. I know that. Elliot's been on shows that you produced before, including the Roenick show. He's you know, obviously a very bright guy. And, you know, you probably were really interested in the hockey stuff. To me, his explanation and story about what happened at the Olympics in Rio was fascinating. He's told a little bit of that before. I'm not sure he's ever gone into that detail. And he's really beaten himself up about that. Now, it's easy for me to sort of step back and say, you know, once you sort of say you screwed up, to me, understand that, like, people are pretty forgiving and they know that stuff happens, but there's a reason why these guys have these jobs, and on these major moments, if there's a screw up like that, it's so hard to let go. And I thought he gave you, if nothing else, a real honest account of why making that Phelps Lochte call incorrectly just really killed him.
Well, not even getting that coverage here, obviously. I didn't even know about it because I'm following the Olympics in the United States. I don't get that broadcast, and for whatever reason, I know in this
you
day
might have
and age,
just missed it. It got some pretty good pickup,
right? It got pickup, but I just missed it. It was just one of those things where I just missed it. I didn't see it on social media, and I even follow Elliot. I've known Elliot for a long time, so it should have been on my radar, but it wasn't. So hearing him tell this story, it was oh my God, I can't believe this happened. And man, you must have felt terrible. And you could hear it in his voice that he was very sheepish telling the story. Like, I can't, you know, even to this day, it sounds like, I can't believe I actually made that mistake. Oh my God, the biggest swimmer in the world. And maybe the second biggest swimmer, well, by
right up there, right?
Whatever you want to call Ryan Lochte.
What did you think of him saying Austin Matthews' potential impact on Gary Bettman, which is pretty interesting?
I think it's a great point. I think it's an absolutely great point. There's a lot of things that Commissioner Bettman has done that a lot of people don't realize because he, and I'm not saying this because I'm an American, there are situations and circumstances where he actually saved hockey in Canada because the Edmonton Oilers, they're still in existence. They had no money. He doesn't like moving teams. It's not like he wanted to take the Atlanta Thrashers and move them to Winnipeg. It's just this is what needed to be done in order to save the team. And relocation and expansion are things that he wants to expand, but relocation is not one of the things. I know this because I worked on his radio show for years. And the Austin Matthews comment is very true because it is exactly what the NHL wanted to do. Ever since Wayne Gretzky went to LA, they wanted to make hockey fashionable in California. They wanted to get into the warmer weather climates in Nashville and in Florida. And they're doing that. The Tampa Bay Lightning were in the Stanley Cup Finals a couple of years ago. Maybe they'll win
another cup.
Yeah, maybe they'll get there this year. The San Jose Sharks were in the Stanley Cup Final last year. The LA Kings have won a couple of Stanley Cups. So it's all working. But now you have an American kid in a warm weather climate state of Arizona, now the first overall draft pick, and will eventually be the captain of the Toronto Maple Leafs and get them back on the upswing. He was not wrong in that statement, and I think it is one of the greatest things Gary Bettman has done during his tenure as commissioner.
It's going to be interesting to watch his maturation. Austin Matthews, obviously that 4-goal game in his first game ever was incredible.
But you're right. Also, you said it. The league is in good hands. You saw that under 24 team at the World Cup, and you just see what Lion A has done for Winnipeg. You saw what Connor McDavid does. You saw what Puljarvi does for Edmonton as well.
Eichel
in Buffalo and Matthews and Marner in Toronto. Yeah. I mean, it's fantastic what's going on.
It's going to be really good. Well, our thanks to Elliot Friedman for being a guest on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. Previous recent guests include David Farenthold of the Washington Post. That's the reporter who may win a Pulitzer for his work on Trump's charitable giving or not giving. Also broke the Access Hollywood story. Let me thank everybody at Digital Media, including my producer Lou Pellegrino. Thanks to Ben Eagle, Alan Kim, Ryan Hunt, and Chris Stone at SI. This is Richard Deitch. We'll see you again on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
This has been a Digital Media production. Find your voice.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network? The number one daily sports podcast network. Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.